This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on New Books in Intellectual History, we have Dr. E. James West, author of Our Kind of Historian, The Work and Activism of Lerone Bennett, Jr. Welcome to the show, Dr. West.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking some time out to talk about your important book, Our Kind of Historian, which is a pivotal work in, I think, African-American intellectual history, as well as the history of the Black press. First, we will discuss Dr. West's biography, his teaching and research interest, and then we'll go into a more in-depth analysis of his book, Our Kind of Historian. So tell us a little bit about your teaching and research background.
Sure. So I'm based in the UK. I did my undergraduate and postgraduate degrees in the UK and work at a British university. So that's kind of the background to where I'm based. In terms of the type of stuff that I teach, so I'm a lecturer in modern American history. So most of my research focuses on the Black press in the United States, broadly defined. And beyond that, you know, I teach on across a range of modern American history topics. So in the UK generally, you don't have that many Americanists within a given program, so you're usually required to teach across, you know, a fair amount of material. So that'll involve like most American history from Revolution onwards. But for me, it's kind of predominantly 20th century stuff.
So what led you to study history, and I guess more particularly African American history, given that you're based in the UK? I would imagine, did you have much exposure to courses in African American history, say in undergrad?
Yeah, so African American history in the UK is very popular. Like British schools and also universities have worked out that they can effectively negotiate race by transplanting those discussions onto African American history and avoiding discussions of race within the context of Britain. So most, when I was doing my A-levels, which is what you do when you're kind of 16, 17, 18 in the UK, there were courses there on the African American civil rights movement in a kind of classical framing. So, you know, 54 to 68 kind of framing. And that's a very popular course at that level in the UK. There wasn't any discussion really of race within the context of British history or Britain and empire, at least when I was at school. I know it's changed a little bit since then. So, you know, for a lot of British students at that level, their engagement with questions of race and power and inequity really come through the lens of African-American history, and particularly the modern civil rights struggle. That was really my entry point into thinking about African-American history. And then also African-American history is quite popular, particularly courses on civil rights are quite popular at British universities as well. And again, that's a way to kind of offset or transplant discussions of race away from the British lens and to think about it in terms of the US. So I think a lot of the way that British people think about race is or kind of civil rights particularly is, you know, that's something that happens somewhere else. A lot of British undergraduate students will be able to list you the names of, you know, prominent civil rights leaders in the US, but they probably wouldn't be able to name many, if any, civil rights leaders or black leaders in Britain. And that speaks to a real kind of gap in the way that British universities teach about these subjects. And to an extent, that's starting to change now. And there are a lot of scholars working within the UK Academy now who are doing a very good job of trying to address that balance. So Kenneta Hammond-Perry, who's at De Montfort University in Leicester, is one person who's taking a lead on that. But it kind of speaks to that broader issue. But that's really the way that I, along with many people who kind of had a similar educational experience to me, began to engage with African-American history. So I did courses at undergraduate level that were, you know, civil rights courses. I did courses on kind of like slavery in the US, Jim Crow, that kind of thing. And that was the entry point.
That's interesting that you say it's popular in the UK, because I know recently in a US context, advanced placement courses in African-American history are just now starting, you know, and they made, College Board made this big announcement, oh, we're going to have this pilot program and start an AP course in African-American history. And there's like, it seems like, especially now, there's a lot of resistance. There's always been resistance, obviously, teaching African-American history in the American context. So that's an interesting, you know, view of the popularity in the UK. So let's turn more directly to this question of intellectual history. It's a question I like to ask everybody that I interview. And, you know, intellectual historians are always obviously kind of debating the definition of their field and how to define it and so forth. So how would you define intellectual history, but more directly African-American intellectual history?
Yeah, I'm going to probably caveat it with saying that I'm not really an intellectual historian. So my ideas about this probably less well formed than other people you might have interviewed. But for me, beyond the kind of just broader history of ideas model, I'm really interested in the framing, the kind of Gramscian framing of the division between the kind of, I guess the Gramscian model is like the organic intellectual. So intellectuals who kind of associate or affiliate themselves with kind of marginalized social classes versus a more traditional elitist view of the intellectual, which I guess is the kind of the capital I intellectual idea of the kind of cerebral figure who's thinking about these big ideas, but not necessarily rooting those ideas within or to a kind of investment in bettering the lives of marginalized communities or social groups. And that's the way that I kind of approach thinking about Lerone Bennett and his position. And I think that's something that, and I'm sure it will come up quite a few times, the objectivity question. And I know that the AHA decided to wade in on that, or well, maybe not organizationally, but one individual. And I think for a lot of African-American people who we would see as part of a kind of canon of African-American intellectual history, that idea of intellectual history being a more abstract idea has always been quite facile, because you know, what is the purpose of thinking about ideas of, you know, intellectual, like not just the thinking about the broader ideas of intellectual history, and but also thinking about how we apply those ideas for pragmatic real world benefits, and, you know, for African American historians and intellectuals, primarily the betterment of African American people, and thinking about racial justice and racial uplift. So, yeah, within the kind of broader framing of African of intellectual history, I think, you know, African American intellectual history as a subcomponent of that is very important, because it obviously reminds us that this division between a kind of traditional elite intellectual and then the organic intellectual quite quickly breaks down when we kind of look at marginalized groups or marginalized people within American history. So yeah, that's kind of my entry point into intellectual history. And then obviously Bennett is the person that I'm most interested in for this book.
Sure. I would imagine you will have critics, if you haven't already read, you know, reviews of your book, who would probably say, well, is two questions they might raise is, Bennett a historian? Is he an intellectual? He's, you know, you're using the Gramscian framework, so more like a public intellectual and or activist intellectual. And that's a big debate too, obviously, in intellectual history. You know, what does that mean then? Right. Is he a presentist? We're not going to go there. I thought it was just, put in there as we start to look at the book.
I'm just going to, I mean, I don't even know why this, like, yeah, we can just allow that, but that I'm not going to like rant about that guy's article, but it just didn't even make sense, because it's like one of the first things that undergraduates like break down is the kind of like fallacies and limits of the idea of historical objectivity. So the fact that the, you know, one of the main guys in the AHA seems really hung up on this idea still, seems a little bit bizarre. And then also it's only really a problem when like brown people or women do it, or I don't know. I didn't really understand what his thing was, but yeah, we can leave that alone. Lots of people have more eloquently taken that apart than I could.
Yeah, I mean, definitely looking at somebody like Bennett is in his, like, I don't want to say contempt or disdain for this notion of objectivity, and the fact that, you know, he's saying, hey, you know, I need to use what I have to get freedom. You know, the work itself is a part of the project of Black freedom, you know, trying to document our history and our past and using it kind of as a tool or weapon to secure some freedom at the present. But let's talk sources. Obviously, this is one of the first extended histories of the life and work of Lerone Bennett. And so I'm wondering about sources and your access to sources. Can we talk a little bit about the sources you came across and putting this book together, and maybe some challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. So the two most important resources in terms of papers for this project were two. So when I started the process of this book, and a previous book that also involved Bennett quite heavily, those two archives were unprocessed, and then they've kind of been getting processed as I've been writing. And then so one of those paper collections is at Emory University, and that's a relatively small but quite rich collection of Bennett's papers. And then there's another much larger collection at Chicago State University. So those are the two most important individual papers that I used. And I'll just quickly say, particularly the Chicago State papers, that was only really possible through a fellowship that I had with the Black Metropolis Research Consortium in Chicago, and particularly the generosity of archivists at Chicago State, in particular Aisha Haeckel, who I believe now she's based in Charleston, and then Raquel Flores Clemens. And they were, really instrumental in helping me get access to those papers. And then outside of that, a lot of papers that were connected to people at Johnson Publishing Company. So there's a lot of different editorial papers scattered around the place, across the country. So a lot of those are in Chicago, people like Irabel Thompson or Ben Burns, who were both influential editors early on in Johnson Publishing's history, in Atlanta, at Emory, but also, Atlanta University Center and Morehouse. There's papers related to other editors, people like Bob Johnson, Hoyt Fuller, the Schomburg Center, Library of Congress, a few other places. Like, those are the main places in terms of archival material. So that was, you know, really important. And then also I didn't meet Bennett during his life. I didn't have a personal relationship with him. And we can talk about, you know, how that impacted the way that I wrote this book and maybe some of the limitations of that. But I'm fortunate to have a good relationship with his eldest daughter, Joy. And Joy's been, you know, really supportive and really generous with her time, in terms of letting me look at, you know, some material that she has, and then also just answering questions. And I've done a couple of interviews with her as well. And yeah, like, that relationship's been really, really important, because obviously, you know, I'm coming at this history, you know, the book's called Our Kind of Historian, but, you know, I'm a white British scholar. Like, I didn't really engage with Bennett much prior to this project. Like, he's not someone who I grew up with. You know, I didn't really know what Before the Mayflower was, you know, when I was growing up. So that relationship was super important for me, because it was really important for me to kind of have a clear sense of what I was trying to do with this book, and also the limitations based on my positionality as a white British scholar, and then also what I could and couldn't do, and the stories that I was and wasn't able to tell through this book. And I think that relationship with Joy is really important for keeping that at the forefront of my mind as I was, you know, writing the book.
Right. Yeah. Before the Mayflower, we all know, you know, African-American growing up in the U.S., my parents, you know, I think you capture that really well, what that book meant to African-Americans. And just you're expected to see that on everybody's shelf. You know, my parents had their copy, you know, this, and we probably still have it somewhere in the family. You know, seeing that copy of the book, that was the definitive, that was our history, you know, and just having this relationship with not only that book, but Ebony Magazine. And at some point I might, as we get to the end of our questions, maybe if we could talk about what Ebony has meant and has anything replaced it at the present, you know, if we get a chance. So let's talk about Lerone Bennett Jr. and how he fits the definition of an intellectual. And then we'll turn directly to your book, more directly to your book.
Yeah, so Bennett, he's not someone who comes from the way that he becomes a public historian or a public intellectual is not a direct line. You know, he's born in the South. He's born in the Delta, in the Mississippi Delta in Clarksdale. And early on in the book, I spend quite a lot of time about the geography and thinking about the geography of where he grew up. And that was really important for me, first of all, just to kind of get a fuller sense of, you know, what is the sea that Bennett is swimming in within the context of, you know, 1930s Jim Crow Mississippi, and the way that informs his early life. But also that experience growing up in Mississippi really puts in place some of the core ideas that he has about the role of history and the function of history and its relevance and power for Black people, that he kind of realizes in a fuller sense through his later professional career. So yeah, his time in Mississippi and growing up in Jackson in particular was really formative for him. intellectually, even though, you know, he wasn't thinking at that time, you know, how am I going to conceptually write about and think about history later on? You know, it was just very formative. But then looking back, it was obviously a really important moment. And then he goes from Jackson through the school system, and then he decides that he wants to go to Morehouse. And he wants to become, you know, a Morehouse man, this quite gendered vision of black excellence that he sees embodied through some people, some of the men that he knows in Jackson. And then he goes to Morehouse, and Morehouse in Atlanta is, you know, an incredibly important period in his life. You know, he comes under the influence of Benjamin E. Mays, who alongside, you know, John H. Johnson is one of the most important male figures in his life, and a really major influence over his thinking about activism and about, you know, writing and education. And then he ends up, he works for a short period for the Atlanta Daily World, one of the few daily black newspapers in the country. And that's his, you know, his training almost as a professional black journalist. And then he moves to Chicago in the early to mid 1950s. So he's coming of age at this really, really interesting moment within the kind of broader arc of African American history. When you think about, you know, he's born in 1928, and he grows up within the context of the Depression in Mississippi, and then he enters Morehouse at a really critical moment in that institution's history during World War II, where it's really struggling for students, and Benjamin Mays arrives as the Morehouse president, and he really transforms the institution in quite a short period of time. And that's obviously the period as well that, you know, like Martin Luther King's at Morehouse, Bob Johnson is at Morehouse, like some of these other really influential figures are coming through Morehouse at this particular moment in the mid 40s into the late 40s, early 50s. So it's a really generative moment for Bennett. Puts him in contact I accidentally turned my microphone off then. Puts him in contact with you know, some of the people who are a mainstay throughout the rest of his life.
No, I think a good point, that chapter of Morehouse Man and what that means to, you know, black masculinity and the African-American experience, and what the Morehouse Man looks like, right, in terms of the style of dress and comportment, and why that was such a formative moment in his life. But can you briefly lay out your argument concerning Lerone Bennett Jr.? Because, again, he's been overlooked in the sense that, is that because of access to sources, or is it that, you know, do we put him, we don't put him next to, or historians haven't placed him next to somebody like W.E.B. Du Bois as our historian? You're calling him our kind of historian and making, you know, a point, I think, of delineation between who he was. Can you tell us a little bit about your overarching argument, kind of distill it for our audience a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So that the title of the book, Our Kind of Historian, comes from a quote from Ishmael Reed, which was quite late in Bennett's life. He was getting a prize from, I think it was the American Book Awards, it was about 2002. And Ishmael Reed has this great, you know, it's quite a short speech when he's presenting this award. It's a Lifetime Achievement Award to Bennett. And he's talking about him as a trailblazer in the quest for a more accurate and inclusive interpretation of American history. And this description of Bennett as our kind of historian, I think is great. And it does a really good job of getting to the heart of what Bennett's appeal is. And I think for a lot of his readers, and overwhelmingly we're talking about African-American readers, it's not just that Bennett is writing history in a way that's kind of interesting and lively and entertaining. It's also that he has a very clear vision of why he's writing the history that he's writing and what the function of that history is and who his audience is, like who he's writing that history for. And I think that's at the heart of this really strong relationship that he develops with the broader African-American community. And yeah, you've already mentioned Before the Mayflower, obviously, and some of his later work, you know, Forced into Glory, The Challenge of Blackness, those kind of texts. He writes in a way that really connects with people. And that's, I think, at the heart of his popularity. And, you know, people like John Hope Franklin and Du Bois and other Black historians and intellectuals, like, you know, they're very well known, but there's not that kind of warmth or intimacy of the relationship, I think, in the same kind of way for a lot of people as there was with Bennett. And I think that's really at the heart of his appeal. And it's that kind of specific connection, which informs, you know, the title of the book, but then more broadly, the way that I think about Bennett's work and his relationship to the African-American community.
Yeah, I was going to throw John Hope Franklin out there, but I you know, I see your larger point in terms of his access and his public as a public historian, really, before it becomes in vogue. You know, he's a public figure, public historian. He's speaking to the masses as opposed to writing textbooks for, you know, a college classroom. You know, Bennett's classroom is the African-American population, masses. And there's the Gramscian framing, of course, obviously makes the most sense in looking at him as a public intellectual. So tell us a little bit more about Ebony, right? The central role of Ebony in the lives of African-Americans is well known, obviously. But how did Bennett come to edit, you know, Ebony magazine? And I want to get to the importance. I mean, I think we know the obvious importance of Ebony magazine, but its declining importance. And if you're making this argument about the central role of Bennett, is he replaceable? Has anybody stepped kind of into that role with the decline of print media? You know, or if that's even possible, right? But so tell us a little bit about his journey into Ebony magazine.
Yeah, sure. So Ebony, I mean, I'm sure many listeners are familiar with Ebony already, but just for a quick recap, John H. Johnson is a kind of migrant from Arkansas. He moves to Chicago with his mother in the 30s. He gets a job at Supreme Life, which is a, you know, one of the largest Black insurance companies in the country, and he kind of edits the newsletter effectively, and then he gets this idea of creating a digest for African American readers. So he starts the Negro Digest, which is later renamed as Black World in a later edition or iteration, and that's very popular. And he very very quickly becomes one of the most widely circulating Black publications, Black periodicals in the US. So 3 years later, in 1945, he starts this much more ambitious publication, which is basically he envisions it as a Black counterpart to Life magazine. So it's this photo editorial publication that he calls Ebony. And it's a, you know, it's a huge success. Politically or kind of ideologically, people have issues with it because it's very much, you know, like, it was very consumerist, and Johnson's ideas about, you know, the route to Black liberation will basically come through democratic capitalism, which, you know, obviously some people disagree with. But Ebony as a publication is enormously successful. And, you know, within a very short period of time, it's by some distance the most popular Black periodical in the United States and indeed the world. And he's able to really become the first Black publisher to successfully attract like major white corporate advertising. And this just is a massive revenue stream. And he starts to plow this back into trying to attract some of the best and brightest young Black journalists in the country to Chicago. And one of those people is Bob Johnson, Robert Johnson, who was then working at the Atlanta Daily World. And he comes and he starts working on Jet, and Bob Johnson eventually becomes the like base, the managing editor of Jet, or the executive editor of Jet. And when Bob Johnson arrives, he speaks to John Johnson. He says, you know, there's another guy down in Atlanta that I've worked with, and you should really take a look at him. You know, he's got the stuff, which was Lerone Bennett. So on Bob Johnson's recommendation, John Johnson invited Bennett. Bennett, you know, decided it was the right time to leave Atlanta, a new challenge. He comes to Chicago. Initially, he works for Jet, but then after about a year, he moves to Ebony. And then, you know, throughout the 50s, he's making his name at Ebony. You know, he's a well-respected journalist. He gets some choice assignments. But, you know, no one thinks of him as a historian. Like, he's not writing historical pieces, you know. The thing that really changes is that Bennett persuades Johnson that he's the right man to take on a series that Ebony runs, which is kind of envisioned in the late 50s, and then it runs in the early 60s, which is a Black History series, you know, the first major Black History series that the magazine has done. And that's the basis. That series is the direct basis for what becomes Before the Mayflower. And that's really that series. And Before the Mayflower is what transforms Bennett's role in a very, very short period of time. So Bennett goes from being, you know, a well-respected, very capable journalist, but not really someone who's seen as a kind of like a public intellectual or public historian or anything like that. Very quickly, the enormous success of the Ebony Black History series and then the enormous success of Before the Mayflower catapult Bennett into this position as being one of the nation's most visible Black popular historians. And that's really kind of the basis for his relationship with the magazine and then his relationship with the, you know, broader community moving forward.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
I, you know, as you were talking, I started to think about, you know, the second part of that question is about who steps into that space in terms of a print magazine or maybe television media as an institution that Ebony was. And I just started thinking about BET and how it becomes to an extent a laughing stock among, you know, African-American comedians and, you know, the Boondocks. Obviously that cartoon is constantly lampooning BET as when you think of Black media conglomerates, we think of Ebony, we think of Jet, we start to think of BET, but it doesn't have the same place or space in Black life that Ebony does. And it even to an extent becomes, I don't want to say it becomes kind of a joke, but for Aaron Magruder it does, right? Like, it couldn't step into the space that Ebony was. And, you know, that's just, an interesting question for me. Do you think there's anyone who in Black media at the present is comparable to Lerone Bennett Jr. or institution that's comparable to Ebony?
I don't think so. And I think a lot of it is a kind of specific context to specific kind of confluence of different people. Johnson Publishing as an institution, I don't think it's an exaggeration to describe Johnson Publishing as one of the most important Black institutions of the 20th century. I'm talking primarily in terms of culture, but I think also economically, politically, it has a role. I mean, for a period, Johnson Publishing is the largest Black company in the country at its peak. There's always been people who are critical of Ebony. Like, I'm very, very critical of Ebony in many ways. And the thing that I find interesting about it as a magazine is that I feel like everyone's point of view is kind of valid on it. Because if you think, oh, it's like quite a vapid consumerist piecemeal, like, it's just full of like fluff pieces on celebrities. Yes, that is true. But also it publishes some really insightful pieces, important pieces. Some of its key, if you look at some of its key special issues, like its 1969 issue on the Black Revolution, that's like you look at the list of people who are contributing to that issue, and it's like, it's not a list of people that you might traditionally associate with Ebony magazine. You're looking at people like Huey Newton and Don Lee, or subsequently Haki Madhubuti, and you're looking at like quite radical figures. And I think that it was almost a kind of chameleonic publication in the way that it has this diversity of positions and perspectives. And I think Johnson as an individual, John Johnson as an individual, there's lots of things you can criticize him for, but I think from a business perspective, he makes a really interesting decision to have like a very diverse slate of people writing for Ebony. And writing for some of his other magazines. And I think that is admirable. And I think there's certainly lots of other things that we can criticize Johnson for in terms of the way that he organizes and runs his business. But I think the willingness to have a diversity of Black perspectives within the publication is really important. And I think that's probably what separates it from more recent Black media. That kind of diversity of perspectives, I would say. So that's one part of it. And then also, just based purely on numbers, like if you look at market saturation, so Ebony at its peak, if you look at like, if you include pass-on readership, pretty close to about one in every two adult African-Americans were reading like at least some portion of the magazine every month. And that kind of level of engagement, of market saturation, like you're not going to get that again on a sustained level. Like the only thing that I can really think of that is comparable, but it's in a much more intensive moment, is the percentage of African Americans who watch Roots, the original television miniseries, and the data that we have on that suggests anywhere upwards of 75% of African Americans watch Roots. Or it watched at least one part of the original 8-part miniseries. But that's over like a period of weeks or months, right? Whereas Ebony has an enormous sustained readership, really from, almost from when it starts, the readership's high and the readership stays high, certainly into the 90s, and then it starts to drop off quite a lot. But, it's to have that level of sustained engagement, and just in terms of a pure numbers basis of like the number of people who have it in their home, and they might not agree with it, but it's very much like it's the coffee table magazine, everyone has it in their home. I'm really struggling to think like what would today would be comparable to that.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's in the change in new media, there's so many forms of media now, there's, Black Twitter is a country, right? I like to say, it's just like so many different forms of media competing, you know, for the attention of, you know, the Black community in social media, television media. Yeah, I think that's a great point about the longevity over decades and its reach. Because I could definitely tell you, you know, Ebony Magazine was always there on the table. My mom was always carrying a copy of Ebony Magazine, you know, to and from work. So, point well taken. So you talk also about earlier in the book, to quote, Black women played a dominant role in shaping, you know, Bennett's early life. How so and why? If you have any particular example of the women who shaped him in his earlier life.
Yeah, sure. So I think it's, well, first of all, I'll separate between Bennett's relation, like kind of personal relationships with the Black women in his life, and then the role of Black women in the way that he writes about history, because I think that's a little bit different. And I do have criticisms in the book about, in some ways, the way that he thinks and writes about Black history is quite gendered. But in terms of like more personally, he's raised by his mother and grandmother effectively. His parents, you know, separate when he's very young, and he moves with his mother, Alma, to Jackson, and she raises him. And also Lucy Reed, who's his grandmother, she has an enormous influence in his early life. He later describes her as, you know, the greatest person he's ever met. You know, he holds her in that kind of esteem. So they had a very important influence, and not just in terms of him, but also the way that they enabled him and provided him with opportunities to engage with, particularly reading, which was a, you know, huge passion from a very early age for Bennett. So they actively facilitated that. You know, education was a massive priority for them. I have this short story in the book about when he's very young, Bennett comes back from school and he's been giving a report card where I think he's failing. It might be comprehension or it might be something else. So then Alma basically marches down to the school. And bearing in mind, this is within the context of, you know, Jim Crow Mississippi. She's a working class, single Black woman, taking it down to the school and just being like, you don't know what you're talking about. You guys are idiots. Like, my son is not like failing this. And then she pulls him out of that school and puts him in another school. And those relationships are super important in terms of establishing, you know, kind of core values for him, but also providing him with opportunities and what they valued for him growing up. So that's one kind of aspect of this. And then some of his early teachers, particularly a teacher called Manning, who was the person who really kind of gets him engaging with history for the first time. You know, he talks a lot later in his life about the importance of Miss Manning and her role in getting him to think about history, like the way that he writes about history later on, which is very kind of engaging and accessible and lively. Like, a lot of that comes from those early experiences with history with Miss Manning in the Jackson school system. So those are just kind of two examples. And then later on in his life, you know, his wife Gloria plays a really important role, albeit a very, you know, publicly underappreciated role in his career. So the couple have four children within a quite short period of time. And it's not just that Gloria, who was a very talented journalist in her own right, she and they actually met at Johnson Publishing. She kind of largely gives up her journalism career to look after and care for the children, and that provides Bennett with the space to become this public figure. But also she plays a very important role in like helping him think through his work. She kind of sometimes edits his work, and you know, that's a very familiar story in terms of gendered labor and the underappreciated role of the women or partners of people who we see as intellectuals. So that's not, that's by no means something that's exclusive to Bennett. But yeah, it's worth obviously flagging the Gloria's role in what he would later become in terms of his public prominence.
And you mentioned, you know, his daughter and preserving the history with the papers that she has and documents, you know, down to the present that you mentioned earlier in the show, how she played a major role in you getting at least your, you know, research out there and supporting, really preserving her father's legacy, I think is, you know, very interesting too.
Yeah, I think for Joy as well, like Joy was a journalist. So she kind of, I think she understood that aspect of her father's professional career, like very well. And they actually, I believe they worked together for a short time at Johnson Publishing, you know, towards the end of his life or his career there. And Joy is someone who's very, I think she's very invested in maintaining or preserving like her father's work, but not in a kind of gatekeeping way. At least that's not my experience. So I think it's more just she, you know, because there's been stuff that I've like come across that doesn't paint Bennett in a favorable light by any means. And she's, you know, she's never really suggested like the way that I should write stuff. You know, she's been very engaged, but then in terms of the actual process of me writing stuff, she generally doesn't really like care about that too much, because she's kind of like, she understands the process of writing. You know, she comes from that journalistic background. So she's been supportive, but also not trying to, you know, guide or steer material, which has been, you know, really useful.
Sure. So tell us more about Bennett's role in the civil rights movement, civil rights era, including, you know, his writings at that time. What, you know, how does he shape civil rights movement, in what ways, you know, through his writings and so forth?
Yeah, so I think there's probably two quotes that are kind of at the forefront of my mind thinking about that question. And the first is Jesse Jackson. So Jesse Jackson described Bennett as the most read voice of the freedom struggle. And that's a direct quote. And we can litigate, you know, whether that's actually true or not, but it gives a sense of like his reach, particularly during the 60s and into the 70s. And then also the other aspect of this is someone like John Henry Clark, who writes this really interesting profile of Bennett, which appears in Freedom Ways in, I think, early 1965. And he describes Bennett as one of the most prominent figures as this like new wave of black scholars who were effectively activist intellectuals, who are people who are not just writing about the movement, but who are on the movement front lines in some ways, who are active participators in, as well as astute interpreters of. That's a quote from Clark. So those two kind of ideas really framed a lot of the way that I thought about his role. And I think the way that I try and map it out in the book is you see this transition in Bennett's writing, and you see in a very real way how his engagement with activism, his direct connection to both his participation in the civil rights movement, and then also his relationship to activists, prominent activists within the movement, how these shape his writing in really interesting ways. So you go from the early 60s, where, you know, he writes Before the Mayflower, and he writes it in a very kind of engaging and accessible way. But it's not really a kind of theoretical text, or he's not really thinking deeply about the relationship between black history and black activism. But then by the end of the 60s into the early 70s, he's writing these really interesting, quite theoretical, conceptual collections. So the one that I would flag for people listening is The Challenge of Blackness, which came out in 1972, and which is a collection of speeches and addresses and essays. And that, the difference between the content of Before the Mayflower, which I believe first comes out in 1962, and then The Challenge of Blackness, which comes out a decade later, it really showcases how Bennett's position changes and how the way that he thinks about Black history and Black activism shifts during this period, and how that's informed by his relationship with, you know, other people at Johnson Publishing Company, other people within the movement, people like James Baldwin and Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture. So yeah, it's a really interesting moment in his life. And again, you know, I think for Bennett, thinking about him more broadly, it's useful because that's a transition or an evolution that a lot of people undergo during this process, so, or this period. So this, you know, this is by no means Bennett alone. And that's one of the things that I think so interesting about him as a character, like the questions and the struggles that he has and the way that he thinks about Black history and Black activism. For a lot of people, they're, you know, going through the same type of thing. And he is very good at vocalizing those type of questions and issues for people. And then, you know, seeing that transition, I think is really interesting.
No, definitely. As you talk about the transition, as we sort of come to our last question about his views on reparations, tell us a little bit about his views on reparations.
Yeah, so this is one of the, and just for context, so for listeners, I wrote an earlier book called Ebony Magazine and Lerone Bennett Jr., which was focused more specifically on his role at Ebony. And then when I kind of wanted to do a more specific biography project, which was larger, and one of the big reasons was I wanted to talk about some of these other really interesting aspects of Bennett's life that I didn't get the chance to talk about in terms of his relationship with Ebony, and the reparations debate was one of those. So Bennett, he has this kind of really interesting moment towards the end of his professional career, at least, because his role at Ebony changes in the late 80s, and he starts to write a lot less. And it seems like he's kind of tapering off a bit. But then you get this 1-2 punch around the turn of the 21st century. So you see the publication of Forced into Glory, which is his, you know, highly controversial magnum opus, if you like, of Abraham Lincoln as a white supremacist, which, you know, is one of the books he's probably most well known for now. And then he plays this kind of influential role locally in Chicago in the movement for reparations. And Bennett's role, so he is not someone who is leading the revived demand for reparations, which come around the turn of the 21st century. You know, he's not really connected to organizations like UNCOBRA. He's not someone like Randall Robinson, who's, you know, at the front line of that. But what I wanted to show in this book is some people are quite dismissive of Bennett. They lump him in with like Black public intellectuals or public figures who basically kind of jump on the reparations bandwagon. But what I wanted to show was that actually these ideas were something that Bennett had been thinking about for decades, and you can actually trace that lineage back to, you know, the 1960s in Chicago and the way that he's writing about the idea of reparations then. So that was, you know, a really important way for me to kind of finish off the book, if you like, because I wanted to show that there was this revival of interest in reparations, and Bennett played a kind of interesting role in Chicago. You know, he has this really impassioned speech at a public hearing where the Chicago Council is debating whether to pass a resolution on reparations. And Bennett's speech plays a really big role in seeing the passage of that resolution. And that's, I think, one of the first, it might be the first in a major US city where a city council has passed like a formal resolution on the question of reparations for slavery. So yeah, like in that sense, he has a kind of quite important role in Chicago. But then I really wanted to, again, kind of coming back to one of the overall themes of the book, I wanted to show how this was, you know, the idea of reparations wasn't just something that Bennett picked up in 2000. And ran with within this context of a revived interest in reparations. You know, I wanted to connect it back to, first of all, the way that he had been thinking about reparations throughout his career, but then also link it back to that broader debate about reparations, which goes back into the 19th century, and like people, Callie House and those kind of earlier activists. So it was really part of that. I thought it was a nice way to kind of finish out the book, because it comes back to those main ideas of where Bennett fits within this broader trajectory of African-American history and activism, both individually in the way that he writes and he thinks, but also connecting him to that longer tradition and continuing tradition.
Sure. That's intellectual history, Professor. Looking at these ideas over time and how they developed. And so as we end today, tell us a little bit about what's next for you. I know you have two books that just came out. Man, a very productive scholar. What's next for you?
This biography came out, and then I had a book that came out with Illinois earlier this year, which is, it's called A House for the Struggle, and it's about the Black press and the built environment in Chicago. And then what I'm working on at the moment, so I'm writing, it's a kind of a survey history of the modern Black press for Edinburgh University Press. So I'm writing that at the moment. And then also I'm involved in the Black Press Research Collective with Professor Kim Gallen, who's was at Purdue but recently has now moved to Brown. And we've got some really exciting stuff planned for that. So hopefully there'll be more coming out over the next couple of months about what exactly we're going to be able to do with the Black Press Research Collective moving forward, particularly with an eye on 2027, which is the bicentennial of the Black press in the US. So we've got some exciting stuff lined up for then. So yeah, keep tuned, I guess, for that.
Yeah, sure. It sounds like you're definitely involved in many different projects, and we look forward to reading in your next book and looking at your other research. And thank you again for participating in this interview for the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.